Well, I want to thank Kokyo for inviting me. And thank you all for being here. I really enjoy giving talks and not being part of a formal Zen center. I don't have so much opportunity. Sometimes I give talks to other places, some colleges and other kinds of groups. And I speak in the Sangha that I have, but to other sanghas I haven't had so much opportunity. I have to adjust. I'm used to speaking to people new to Buddhism, which is really fun because you get to be the first indoctrinator. But, but now I have people that know a little bit, so I have to be careful. Can't make up too many stories. But I have a little different way than maybe you're used to in terms of my way of life and my expression of practice. As you can probably tell by the way I look a little bit, at least for a Zen priest, which I don't particularly identify with that role so much, although I do consider myself a kind of full-time practitioner, sometimes I say, or renunciate, sometimes I say, because I give up some of the things that are common in our culture, as, of course, was the style of the Buddha and most of the Buddha's early followers, and also through Buddhist history. So usually when I give talks, I don't have anything prepared beforehand, and I really like to have question and answer. With my own Sangha, I just do talks by, what do you all want to talk about today? And then we have silence for a while until something comes up. It's a little like a Quaker meeting, if you've ever been to that. Mm-hmm. And we're just sitting there until someone's inspired. And then I respond to that, and then at least I'm responding to one person's true interest, as opposed to just assuming everyone's interested in what I think I want to say. But since you all don't know me, I'll talk a little about my life and how my style of practice formed, and then I hope at least half of the time, if there's questions, we can have that and let that kind of guide the rest of it. We were going to get a clock, but I guess that didn't happen. It might be good. Yeah. Thanks. I can go. Once I get going, I can, you know, go to for hours. So try to restrain me.
It's quite dangerous to have given you my clock.
Yeah, I know. But you can still tell me, you need to look at the watch now and tell me what time it is.
You'll break the gong.
Okay, good, good. So the first thing you might notice is I'm wearing this kind of a little bit oddly colored robe, and not the other robes. You know, one time I did. But I'm very interested in the simplicity of the Buddha's life, not just because I want to hang on to something historical, but I think it has a lot to say to our present culture, which has become very unsimple, at least in many ways. To the extent that we're, as many people who know about these things suggest, that we could really be destroying our biosphere within not so long time, because we're living a very resource-intensive life, a complicated life. It was very, very core to the Buddha's original teaching to live in a very simple way. I think he already understood its positive impact. How much more would be left for others, other humans and other creatures as well, if we used less? Even though in his time it was much less dire situation than we have now. So in the present time, I think we need to take these lessons even more seriously. Because of that, I kind of looked at my practice and looked at my life and tried to find out how we can apply the Buddhist principles of simplicity to our present world. And the clothes we wear is just more symbolic, at least to some degree. But the kesa, kashaya, was originally found pieces of cloth that other people discard on the road. And you probably all know this. They sew them together and they dyed them a color. And it was their regular clothes. It was what they wore. It wasn't an additional vestment. although that's a very beautiful tradition to have additional things as well. But I was interested in that, so I'm wearing my robe all the time. I mean, I'm not wearing this one all the time. This was made from drapes that we found in the free box on the street. I dyed it once before, but it was still very light, and because of my lifestyle, it gets very dirty. So I wanted to dye it darker. So just before I came on this trip, I live in Portland, Oregon, and I came down both for this talk and to see my mother, who lives in Emeryville now. So just before this talk, we have a walnut tree in the house I live at, I dyed with black walnut. It was really fun. If you look at my fingernails, you can't see from there, but they're all dyed. It's not nail polish. Black one. I read that you're supposed to wear gloves, but I was like, eh. So I dyed it, and it looked really good at first, but then when it finished drying, it got all kind of mottled and patchy, so that's why that's the way it is. I'll continue trying to learn. But I was trying to follow this old style of finding cloth, sewing it together, and dyeing it. I've kind of been wondering and exploring and experimenting with myself in different forms of practice that we can have that will express compassionately motivated simplicity of life. So I guide a small sangha in Portland. There's a couple of people that live with me, and we practice full time. And then there's a larger group that meets once a week at a local eco-village. Have you heard of eco-villages? You probably have some in Santa Cruz. There's a big one in Portland that was a 32-unit apartment complex that they bought and depaved some of the parking lots and planted all kinds of gardens. They have a spiritual interest, and they were very happy to have us there to lead a group once a week. We've also had our own house periodically over the years, and we've had a camp in Forest Park, a very big park in Wilderness Park in Portland, 6,000 acres, so you can kind of disappear in there and no one can find you. Different things we've experimented with. So I started practice in college. It's probably a lot of people. Those that meet it younger, probably a common place to meet it. My very first teacher is a guy named Tim McCarthy, who was in Kent, Ohio. And if anyone likes Brad Warner's books, have any of you read Brad Warner? I just met Brad once. I don't really know him very well, but his first teacher was also Tim McCarthy. It's the only other time I've ever heard Tim McCarthy mentioned. He was pretty obscure. And I had just started, from the time I started sitting, I was very connected with it. And I decided that was my thing. I kind of gave up what I was in school for. I've graduated, but I just wanted to devote myself to practice. And Tim said, if you're going to practice, you need to go to California and you need to find my teacher, Coven. I said, okay. I guess I was very impressionable at the time. And I went very determined to find Coven, and that proved harder than one might imagine. I went to his first place in New Mexico, and I just thought he'd be there teaching every day. And people were like, no, we don't actually know where he is. There's an old guy, Stan White, though, who's very, very sweet. And not even sure if he's still alive, but I think so. Does anyone know Stan White? Know of him? He gave me a bunch of clothes and a bunch of food, and it was really nice. Then I eventually connected with Coven at Jikoji, close to here, as many of you know, lived there for a little bit. And I was also going to Berkeley Zen Center, and Mel was a teacher for me, Sojin Roshi. Sorry. I'm not that very, don't use the polite forms all the time. Please excuse me. I remember Mel suggesting that I go to Tassajara. He says, you would be really good at Tassajara. You should do some practice periods. And I said, well, the thing is, I'm very concerned about the environment. I think it's in really bad shape. I was already an activist at that time. He said, well, that's That's a very important concern. I'm glad you have that. But if you go to Tassajara for a year and come back, there'll still be environmental problems to work on. So I said, okay, that's a good point. And I did. And that's where I met this guy, still with dreadlocks and a beard and his collection of dead tapes. He hadn't ritually transcended yet. Remember, that was a very, very big moment. We had some good practice periods. I remember some very important experiences I had during them. And we had a band. There was a couple of us young, very enthusiastic practitioners that were doing extra sitting and stuff. And Kokyo and I were two of them. A couple of others, which I don't know where they've ended up these days. And after being there for a little while, though, I felt I really wanted something even more intense and something that would show me more the roots of where the tradition came from. So I thought, of course, it's essential that we learn how to adapt practice to American culture and contemporary culture, but I wanted to see the roots that it came from a little bit, so I was eager to go to Asia. I was most interested in Korean and Chinese Zen at the time, so I was signed up to do a Korean retreat with the Kwannam School. You probably, many of you know the Sungsan Desonsen, and he was still alive at the time. So I was going to do that, and then there was this guy, Fred. Do you remember Fred?
Fred Rosen.
Yeah, Fred Rosen. Old-time practitioner at that time already, so I'm not in touch with him anymore, but we were good friends, and he had done the Korean retreat already. He said, you know, if you're going to do that retreat, why don't you stop off in Japan? It's really close on the way, and I know a really good temple that you might like. It's not all that formal, but the practice is very strong. Would that kind of fit what I was interested in? And it was called Bukokuji. So many of you know the what's called in this country the Harada Yasutani line. It's a mix of Rinzai and Soto, officially Soto, but with some Rinzai influences. So in Japan, it's more known as the Harada line. Yasutani was one of 12 disciples, not particularly prominent there, I think, but very prominent in America because he came here a lot. So the last living disciple of the famous Harada that started that lineage was the teacher of Bukokuji, Harada Tangen Roshi. And he's still alive. He was very young when he became a teacher. So I practiced there for a couple of weeks, did the Korean retreat, went to India, had all kinds of experiences there, did the Buddhist pilgrimage route, and the most important experience was probably I did a long walk across the Himalaya up to Ladakh. Some of you might have heard about Ladakh. And at that time, in the mid-90s, if you went to a village that was several days' walk from the nearest road, you were entering a culture that was pretty much like it was hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Of course, there was some minimal influence from the modern world, but I was very, very deeply moved by how they lived. When you walk into the village, first of all, as you approach the village, you pass chortens, you know, these stupas, and mani walls, these walls made of all these pieces of slate with mantras etched into them, all this, you know, decades and maybe centuries of devotion. So you kind of are purified, you enter this village, and then when someone meets you, the first thing they ask is, are you hungry? Do you need some food? And if you say, well, I've been on the road for a while, I am a little hungry, and say, oh, well, I have some food, please come to my house. And the next thing they ask you is, where are you sleeping tonight? Because it's kind of late in the day. And if you don't have a place, they're like, well, in my house then. And that's just how you treat human beings. You know. And of course, that's what my heart always wanted. Perhaps it's what all of our hearts want in community. But we don't see it so much in our culture. We've kind of become a more private, a little fearful. And so many people, too. We a little anonymous kind of culture. You know, we have to ignore people because there's too many people to pay attention to. But in this context, I could actually see a living example of people with all the homes open to each other, moving from one to the other, supporting each other. A monastery always connected to the village. where they could always go for spiritual rejuvenation. Just a really, really moving situation. And I think what that trip taught me, particularly in India, was, because before I was dedicated to practice, but I wasn't interested in priest ordination or any kind of ordination, because I thought that was all extra. And maybe it is. But what I recognized there was a role for people who were full-time spiritual practitioners that really influenced the village life, the community life, the society around them. It really had an impact. It was integrated. And we've kind of lost that in our culture. Especially renunciates. So people that are living intentionally, simply, for the sake of all beings and for the sake of their practice to develop themselves, but also not to take more than they need as a teaching. That's still very alive in India in general and also in Ladakh. Whereas in our culture, we don't have that. So if we see homeless people, we either ignore them and disdain them, or if we're a little more compassionate, we pity them. Maybe we try to help them. But it's very rare to actually honor them and thank them for living that way. And that makes sense, because they're usually not doing it intentionally, you know, and they might be victims of all kinds of abuse or alcoholism, drug addiction. But that's the only example of really simply living people that we know. Whereas it used to be in older cultures, including European culture that we came from, most of us, our dominant culture here, there were friars and monks and all kinds of people that lived intentionally, simply. So I saw that still alive in India and Ladakh, and I thought this is something we could bring back to our culture so someone can be showing a simpler way to live. Not to ask everyone to do that, but to remind people of these values. And the root of that kind of desire, I think, to live simply is in the very depth of presence practice, what I usually call it, right, what we do in Zazen and what we try to do the rest of the time as well, where we recognize just being alive, just fully tasting this moment's aliveness is all the fulfillment we need in life, is full joy, full potential for joy, which means all those other things we strive to get, there are various schemes and plans and projects, that might be okay. It's not really necessary. A certain amount is necessary, right? To get enough clothes to keep you warm, enough shelter to keep you warm and dry, enough food to eat to be healthy. That was the Buddha's middle way. I was joking with Koki before, we're talking about the middle way. These days, especially in Western Buddhism, since we come from such a comfortable existence, most of us, and a very resource-intensive existence, that people make the middle way wherever they want. And you can always pick someone simpler than you and someone wealthier than you. You know, you might have four houses, and you say, well, my friend has eight houses. That's extreme. I'm the middle way with my four houses, right? So, but the Buddha didn't really teach the middle way to be whatever you want. He kind of based it on, he accepted people from all different walks of life and from all different karma, from all different places, and worked with them from where they were at, of course. But he, if not said directly, I think he did say directly, but also implied through his lifestyle and the lifestyle of his closest disciples, that the middle way is a way that takes care of our body, doesn't punish our body, also takes care of our heart and social needs by creating community, but then stops there, doesn't ask for more. So in the climate of India, you know, wearing basically one set of clothes, a lower robe and an upper robe, and having one extra for when you're washing yourself, that's enough, you know. And begging your food one meal a day. In colder places, then Buddhism adapted a little more food. I practiced in China for a little while, and I didn't know they didn't eat dinner there when I got there, because I thought all of East Asia basically had dinners. They kind of bent that rule a little bit. But when I got there, in the broken English that they could tell me, because I was the only Westerner in the monastery, they said, yeah, there's no dinner. We go for the dining room for breakfast and lunch, and then no dinner. And then I was like, oh, a little taken aback because I really like food. But then I was like, yeah, that's okay. I'm up for that, you know. And but then I remember the first day as it got into the evening, I was getting a little hungry, but it was fine. You know, I was sitting and working with the hunger and Then they came around with this wonderful drink made of these dried fruits, stewed dried fruits and nuts and stuff. And they pour, it's a kind of a medicinal thing. They pour everyone a glass of it. And I said, oh, that's so good. I was like, this is no problem, no dinner. That's fine. And I went back to sitting and they're very strange kind of kinhin that they have. It's really fun. They go, they kind of shuffle in this fast way and they have chants. And all these priests are carrying the kosaku. It's a different looking kosaku, but there's like 20 of them and they all bang them on the floor at a certain time. I had gotten so used to the, you know, the Soto style, which we all do, and we get kind of, we lose our beginner's mind a little bit. So it's really fun to go to a place like this where you don't know any of the rigmarole, you know, so it's all new. But we sat again, and then they came around with this bucket, and out of the bucket came these steamed buns filled with vegetables. You could have seconds. So it was a full-on dinner, you know. And then later they came with soy milk and cookies. So they eat well in the month, at least in the winter they eat well. Yeah. But you know, you don't leave the zendo, which you do for breakfast and lunch. So it's not like a formal meal. It's medicine. That's what's considered a little support to help you out in the cold winter months. So in our sessions we actually do that style. We have a formal orioki for breakfast and lunch, but then for dinner we don't have that, and it's just during the sitting at some point someone will come around, you have your cup and you can get some tea and you can get some food, leftover food and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that seems to work nicely, so you kind of, your meditation isn't as interrupted, but it's kind of fun. You just continue sitting, but then you start eating sitting, and then you're sitting. So, how am I doing? Probably terrible. Yeah, it's already question time. So I practiced, so we did India, and after India I came back and was ordained by Koban. And for me, that ordination was meant dedication to a certain way of life, but it doesn't always. The Japanese priest ordination basically has no stipulations left for lifestyle. It's very flexible. Which has a pro and a con, but we're creating new forms and new ideas for it. But that's what it meant to me at that time. And then I wanted to do formal training, and Koban doesn't really do that. He's more of a, he was more of a, he seems to always be alive, it doesn't matter. But kind of a hermit, artist, poet type. I don't know if he really wrote much poetry, but that kind of type. Very private, very mysterious. He loved to sit and he loved to connect with his students once in a while. He didn't like to train them. He didn't like to pressure them. He wanted them to find their own way. You know? That's why usually at his centers people don't really know how to do the form very well. Because he wanted people to make their own form. You know? Yeah, he would teach like reluctantly sometimes, but the form, I mean. He wasn't so reluctant in teaching very personally about Zazen, but he didn't like people to feel like we have to do it the Japanese way, you know, because he had so much of that when he was young. And he came right in 67 over here. It was like a huge release. Wow, you know, be here now, hippie beings, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of that he liked. It was like a relief. And I think he saw that there was a great seed for rejuvenating practice without too much stricture. So he didn't want to bring the Japanese structure and push it on people. Of course, the form also helps. So it's a balance. And so he ordained me, but I wanted to do more formal training, and he wasn't doing. So I said, well, I went to this great place, Bukokuji, in Japan, and I could go there longer. I'd like to do that. And he said, it's your practice life. That sounds good. Just check in with me once in a while. And so I spent most of the next 5 years at Bukokuji. 1 year I persuaded Kokyo to come join me. I don't know if I persuaded you, but we were in contact and you came. That was great. So he got his taste of all those Japanese things we don't find so much here, like Takahatsu, which is a really, really beautiful practice. Bukokuji is one of the last places that do traditional Takahatsu. Other temples like Eheiji do it as a ritual kind of once in a while. They basically go begging to a rich layperson's house that's offering a very fancy meal and come back. But we actually did it every 5 days during most of the year, and we actually needed to for the income. So, and we ate our lunch, you know, in a abandoned parking lot or something. Sometimes it's Shinto shrine out of a Tupperware, you know. That was a really wonderful practice. Just to walk through streets in public and be able to yell ho at the top of your lungs is just a wonderful practice. It puts you in a different perspective about society and how much we have to follow the rules, you know. Even in Japan now, that's kind of, it's known about at least the older people, but it's very strange and rare. And then to see Westerners do it is even, you know, you get a lot of fun reactions. After some years, I felt I had learned some important things from monastery life, but I also had other things to explore, and I came back to this country. I did some forest activism for a while, living in the trees. Have you heard of the tree sitting people do? Which is a wonderful environment of renunciation, and some of the young people doing that had incredible inspiration to live simply and to be without and to dedicate all their energy to protecting nature, which also means protecting humans, since nature is our home, our original home, and our original inspiration. I was trying to have meditation groups and teach some of them, you know, but they weren't so interested, very much disciplined at that age and in that environment, but there was some success. Some people were interested. And then I ended up staying in Portland and starting this group called Touching Earth Sangha. And it's gone through various phases. Let me stop right now and see if anyone has anything to ask.
I just like to mention one unusual thing you might not know, that to get here for this Dharma talk, Satya rode his bike from Oakland. It took me 2 days to come for the talk. So.
I went very slow yesterday.
Sorry. How did you cross the mountain? What route?
There's a route along 17 you can go. Pretty much all, you take the Los Gatos Creek Trail that starts going up the mountain. And then when you hit 17, you could take this little path to stay off 17. And then you get on old Santa Cruz Highway.
Oh.
And then you get on Summit and you come down.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it was pretty nice. Yesterday's ride wasn't so nice through, you know, all of the East Bay and down. Anyway, I don't use cars, and I try to get around everywhere on bike. I did take the train from Portland to Emeryville. I have ridden from Portland to San Francisco, which is a beautiful, wonderful ride, but you need 2 weeks, and visiting my mom twice a year, 2 weeks each way, it's going to be pretty much so. So I take the train for that. But I try to use the least energy and fossil fuel energy, a lot of human energy, and try to eat low on the food train, be careful about the effects of my food choices. I live on no income, so I'm basically homeless. It's so interesting going to Buddhist centers and saying you're homeless, and they immediately become very worried. Oh, how can we help you? Or, you know, can we offer you something? And I say, see that guy up in the altar? And they're like, yeah, he was also homeless. People forget, you know, just like Christians forget. Jesus was homeless, also intentionally homeless. Because we don't have space for that in our cultural upbringing. It's very strange. I mostly have homes to stay in, so it's not so hard physical life, but I don't have my own home and, you know, have to depend on hosts, which is a little bit different dynamic. And I've been living without money, which is very, in many ways, very, very easy to do practically if you learn about food waste and how that happens. 40% of all food made in this country goes in the garbage unused. So that's some picture of the incredible waste we have. So I work with Food Not Bombs, there's chapters all over the world, there's one here in Santa Cruz. And so we collect so much food, it's just crazy, you know, all organic. We can be they say beggars can't be choosers, we're extremely picky. And we have to compost it after our servings, is so much, you know. So food has been very easy, housing is a little more difficult, there's a big thing with private property in this culture, and people like a lot of space in their homes, unlike in Ladakh where every room is filled with multiple people. But still, you can find people that, you know, I lived for a while with someone, he had his own house to himself, he had some money, but he was kind of depressed and kind of lonely. And he took me in and he took someone else in and we incorporated community, and all of a sudden he was involved in all these other things and I was having my sitting group there. It was so wonderful, you know. But we don't have the network set up for that yet. And there's a lot of learning about living in community that's a little difficult because we didn't, none of us have probably, most of us didn't grow up understanding how that is. We grew up with this ideal of the individual, my personal space and doing everything I want, you know. So even coming together in Sangha just once a week is hard for people sometimes, and living together for a couple months. Mm-hmm. But, okay, sorry.
My sense is that Portland, like Santa Cruz, has a large homeless population. I don't know if the weather is a little more difficult there, but what has been your experience interacting with the communities of homeless in Portland, and how your practice has been influenced by that? Mm-hmm. Somewhat. Sometimes an intentional community, they seem to take care of each other in some ways. What can you speak about?
Mm-hmm. I can try, but to be honest, I don't have too much interaction with what might be called the usual homeless. I mean, what a ridiculous term. Each individual is completely different. But you can say that most people that are homeless would rather not be. I mean, everyone that's out in the elements, unless it's for a short amount of time, would like not to be, including myself, or at least not all the time. And there's a lot of alcohol issues, drug issues, mental health issues. So it's quite a different circle than I'm usually in, although Funat Bombs is a meeting place there. Our Funat Bombs there is really about creating community. So we don't just serve people and they walk off with their food, but it's in a park and we sit down and we try to really get to know each other, and we spread information, we spread resources, where you can get a bike, where you can get a free place to stay for a little while. Mm-hmm. And we talk about issues and spiritual issues and political issues and whatever comes up, which I think is a really important thing that we don't have enough of in our culture. So the makeup of the people is probably more than half people that have places and jobs. You know, lower income people that can really use a free meal, but even some people that don't need it but actually come just for the community, you know. And there are some totally down and out homeless people that come too, but the truth is, I think in most cities in this country, well, I shouldn't say that, anyway, Portland, there's a lot of free food available for people who just want food. And you know, we provide organic vegan food, and that's not always what a lot of the homeless people want. They're very excited about our desserts, but the rest of it they don't necessarily want, that, you know, rice and lentils. They're like, eh. And they can go to St. Francis and get, you know, cold cuts and hamburgers or whatever they get. So we don't get too many of them, but we do get some for sure that really like our food. And we get a lot of people that are a bit struggling, or maybe can't find work, or have just a part-time job. One of the wonderful things is we allow people to just have a part-time job because they don't have to worry about food. Maybe they're just covering rent, which is a little cheaper than here. Then they could spend the rest of their time cultivating their practice or art or whatever it is, or activism, to try to make the world a better place if they can. So that's, I think, a really important function of providing, rerouting some of these wasted stuff to just distributing it to a community. And we all realize, if I don't keep the axe to the grindstone at my work all the time, you know, we think we're going to die, or we're going to end up on the street and be destitute. To know that, no, actually your community will be there and you can eat and maybe you can have shelter too, that's really different than maybe, you know, we can choose, we can wait and choose and cultivate the job that we really want, that we really resonates with our heart and that we really think helps the world, rather than settle for something because we're scared. We have a lot of fear in our culture, I think, not making that rent check or whatever. Yeah.
You said two people live with you and practice full time with you. What is your full time practice? Do you
sitting, not only. So I actually really feel that sitting is an incredible, powerful, and essential practice. But I'm not confident that it's in isolation as nearly as effective as it could be in combination with some other practices. So I've discovered movement practices being very important, and of course I'm not alone with that. There's a lot of movement toward that, I think, in this country. So I learned in Portland, I learned Tai Chi and Qigong. So we do Tai Chi and Qigong every day. And also I had the opportunity to study Indian Raga. Has anyone heard of Indian Raga? Yeah. From a very spiritual point of view, there's a whole range of different kind of raga music, but both the Tai Chi and the raga, I found instructors that were willing to teach me for free. And I found it a very, very powerful practice to include. Yeah, I sing. I also play a bamboo flute, but I started with the flute because I had a very bad ear for my voice. I was a drummer from a young age, and so... I could tell pretty much if other people were in tune or not, but myself, it was terrible. So I was very embarrassed about singing my whole life, you know, and I never sang. And then I thought, singing is such a wonderful thing. I don't want to go through the rest of my life being afraid to sing. So I'm interested in Indian music, and I want to start singing. So I'm going to... First, I started with flute, though, because I was too shy about singing. And I found a wonderful teacher in the Bay Area, actually, in San Rafael, an Indian flute teacher, Jia Sachdev. And I studied with him a little bit. My mother, he charged money. My mother wanted to pay for it. And then I felt a little strange about it with the rest of my lifestyle. And that came to an end eventually. But some teachers in Portland that teach singing, so I added that. It's a great way to learn to sing if anyone doesn't have a natural good ear for your voice, because you use this drone the whole time. So you always have a note to listen to. And the drone represents that constant ultimate mind, we can say. They would say God, often Brahma, right? Brahman. And so you base your singing on that and make your own shape, but you start there and you come back to there. So it's really, you know, it grew up this musical tradition in a very yoga context over many centuries. So I found that that's our form of chanting. So we do that. So raga, qigong, tai chi, and sitting. And then our lifestyle. So we take the... We have our kind of interpretation of precepts, you might say, how to live a spiritual renunciant life. And so the two of them also live without income, and it's not very popular. We got a couple of people. It lasted a couple of years anyway. Yeah. And I'm sorry, I didn't really finish the homeless question. I guess I like connecting with them and talking about being intentionally homeless. And there's things about it, once they lived homeless for a while, that they really recognize and appreciate. And I think a lot of homeless people, it's not, to a degree, it's not what they want to do. But to another degree, there's something about being outside of that system that felt so oppressive that they really appreciate. And I try to confirm that. I say, yeah. I was like, well, let's just get the alcohol level down a little bit, you know, and try to start eating more food and really... But there's a really nice community in the place in the park that we serve food, not bombs, that's there all the time. Very interesting community. Also very sad sometimes. There's one guy I really like that I've gotten to be pretty good friends with. He has food, not bombs tattooed on his arm. And he's not that old. He's in his mid-30s, and he's just going straight downhill because he can't stop drinking. And he has, you know, a grown daughter. And when he talks to me, he really likes to talk to me. And he's like, you know, he's like, I'm such a fuck up. What can I say? It's just, I want to stop, you know. And it's very moving when he's having a hard time. And other people, I know this one guy, he went to Japan, he spent some time there, and he's really interested in spirituality, and he's been off and on homeless. He has a kid with a Japanese wife who lives in Portland, and he's really trying, and he goes off for a while and gets back on. And so. But, I'm spending most of my time trying to create a new kind of homeless community that's a little different. But there are a lot of interesting experiments. There's something called Dignity Village in Portland, where they... set up a place where people can live for free with all kinds of interesting constructions, and some of the more alternative building people have come and helped them build stuff. And it's out near the airport, not the nicest place, but an experiment in community. But you do see among homeless people, not all, but some, is really bonding community that maybe we've lost in some of our more private lives that we you know, even though we have a lot of physical comforts, we don't have that close connection, that sangha. Mm-hmm.
In your community, do you ordinate priests, and do you have to do jukai and the normal kinds of
right. Persons? No, we don't have any of that. I leave it, you know, originally in the Buddha's time, you would shave your head and put on the robes and say, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and boom, you're a monk or nun. The idea is it's really from your lifestyle that determines whether you're a monk or nun, how you practice and how you live. And the ritual of doing it can be very helpful in aligning your vows, you know, and it was a strong experience for me to do that. But the essential thing to me is how you express your life. And if someone's expressing their life as a kind of renunciant, then that's what they are. And if someone, even if they've had no ceremony, and if someone else has had a bunch of ceremonies, but pretty much participating in the same things that we might feel are unwholesome in our culture, then they're not that at that time. They might become that, you know. So I leave it to that. You know, while people come to our Sunday group, they're renunciates a little bit, because we sit outside all the time, even in the winter. It's a little bit tough. But we have lots of blankets. We hand out lots of blankets. People wrap themselves. But that's another unusual aspect of our group. We really feel it's important to connect with nature as an outer environment, to inspire connecting with nature in our inner environment. Because in a sense, Zazen is becoming nature. That's what we become. So we have our artificial constructs of all our ideas, our plans, our schemes, our past and future, basically time and space being separated, which makes our ego, which makes our self story, right? And in sitting, we're trying to let go of that and enter what? Just something that's here already. This seeing and hearing and breathing and the feeling of our body, we didn't make all. It's not our scheme. It's not our plan. It just emerged, right? It's complete mystery. So that's nature. You know, that's realizing, wow, I am nature. Even when you're thinking and scheming, you're also nature, but you can't appreciate it, right? Because you're dominated by your thinking and scheming. So to let go of that is to become nature. And when you surround it exteriorly, so-called exteriorly, obviously it's not really exterior when you're very present and don't have this time-space separation. But when you're surrounded by that influence, it's conducive to feeling like, wow, this tree, actually no one understands how it grew here. It's a total miracle, you know. They still don't understand how photosynthesis works, the best scientists. You know, they have a basic model, but they don't really get it. You know, it's miraculous. And you're sitting surrounded by that, you're like, wow, this consciousness is also miraculous. Whereas if you're always inside, you know, it's also miraculous if you could look carefully enough, because we don't know what electrons are and everything that everything's made of. But when you just look at it on the macro level, it's like... you know, I know someone who did this. I know how they did it, and it provides this function, and I understand. And so it's kind of conducive to our thinking mind a little more. It's like being surrounded by a physical environment of thought, right? And we need it sometimes, just like we need thought sometimes to get to the store and learn, get how to figure out how to feed ourselves, and we need to build shelter to be protected from the harsher elements. But if all we have is that surrounded by our fabricated environment, which now around the world is so massive. You know, you think about traditional peoples, that the vast majority of what they're surrounded with was nature. And a small amount was things that come from human thought. And now we have almost everything you look, not really, but so much that you look at is a product of human thought. It affects our minds. You know, makes us think that, well, that's all there is, my plans and schemes and my thoughts and ideas. But that's not all there is, as we all know from sitting. Right? I don't even remember what question that came from. So, how am I doing? Oh my God, it's almost over. Any other questions? Yeah.
Mine's a little aligned with, you know, what is the practice? I mean, it sounds, you know, wonderful, and I'm wondering, is it Buddhist? Is it everything? Is it Unitarian?
Good question. I don't like the word Buddhist. I don't like it at all. I don't think the Buddha would have used it. Just like I don't think Jesus would have used Christian. I'm not saying not to use it in practical circumstances, sure. But when we really identify, I am Buddhist. Does that even make sense? Buddha means to awaken, right? Buddha means awake. You know, bodh is the verb to wake up. If you know anyone from Poland or who speaks Polish, ask them how to say alarm clock. At least one Polish person told me it's bodh clock, because they have this, you know, because it's Indo-European language, they have this connection. It actually means wake up also in Polish. Anyway, that's what it means. The Buddha, someone is just awake. So can we be an awake-ist? It's like the ist is like putting you to sleep again, you know? Because the ist means I have an identity. I'm this person. I'm walking around, you know, as a Buddhist, you know, which means you're not really alive to what's happening. Because when you're really alive, you don't know who you are. So I prefer not to say, you know, Dogen is famous for saying, don't call yourself Soto. And don't even call yourself Zen. That was really radical. Just say you're Buddhist, because basically anyone who is spiritual was Buddhist in his environment. But now we have so many other religions, so I think we got to up that and say, don't even call yourself Buddhist. Express yourself the way you want to express yourself. Use these beautiful rituals and techniques, but you don't have to hold on to Buddhist. You want to be awake. And then it's so amazing. Then you meet people like Brother David Stendhal-Rost, you all, some of you know him. And you're just like, wow, you're the same. You know? And Sufis, you're the same. Everyone's working on presence and seeing their own ideas as not so all-encompassing is on your path. And you're just using these different dance forms, you know? It's so wonderful.
So as one who, you know, wears the robe that has a lot of ups and downs and ambivalences and struggles about it, but I do it. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, in your view, is there a place for this? And what might that be? Mm-hmm. In accord with your view?
Right. You know, I grew up in New York City, and my parents really liked dance, modern dance, you know, so we go to modern dance, and I really developed a taste for that, and I still like it, and I still go to the very fancy theater in Portland and see modern dance. I just stand outside and ask who has a free ticket, and every time I get one, I've been to maybe 60 shows, they're like $40, $50 tickets. And so I see a lot of, no, I don't see a lot, but I see modern dance once in a while, and it's so beautiful, and that's what we're doing. It's all a dance. If you're a spiritual practitioner, it just means you're performing all the time. Not in the performance of being artificial, but in full attention to expressing yourself in a beautiful way. That's often what I tell people about practice. Specifically, I say when they're having a hard time making decisions, I say, to find out what your heart wants, ask yourself, what's the most beautiful thing? Not the easiest thing, or not the thing that you calculate will make the best effect, but what feels most beautiful, like a beautiful step, you know? And try to let that lead you in your decision. So that's what I think. So if you think a certain form is a beautiful dance, then that's wonderful. If it becomes oppressive and kind of like a thing you have to do, that might not be so wonderful, you know? And there's times to change, and there's times to keep it the same, and there's a beauty in being consistent. And there's a beauty in changing. So it's all, but you have to check in with, is it beautiful? You know, one beautiful thing about robes is you just attract a different kind of attention. You attract questions. It's funny, in some sanghas, the priests wear, maybe here, I don't know, formal robes inside. I mean, I understand why, you know, in the practice place. And then they go outside and they put on regular clothes. I think you should do the opposite. I think in this practice place, everyone understands you're a practitioner. You don't have to wear the robes here. But you go outside, you should put on robes. Because then people are like, hey, what are you? And you do some practice and then you get to talk to them and all this kind of stuff. So I wore robes all the time for a while. And they were kind of traditional. The last robes I had before they totally fall apart were Korean. And a Korean monk gave to me at Jokoji, actually. He was visiting. And people would ask these questions all the time, especially when I ride Amtrak, because that's when I meet random people from around the country, you know, and we have super interesting discussions, usually, especially 3 days to New York and 3 days back. So I think there's a great role in wearing robes. And you, just from your visual impact on people, was it Dogen that said just putting on the robe saves all beings? No, maybe that was Sung San. I don't remember. I think Sung San said, just putting on the robes already saves all beings from suffering. Because you make this expression. You know. But what kind of robes? I don't know. I'm not so interested in perpetuating Japanese forms or even East Asian. Although this is kind of an Asian... I mean, it just makes sense, this tying thing aside. I just like it, you know. But we have to wear something Or we don't have to, but it's nice to wear something noticeable sometimes. I met a Christian wanderer recently, wonderful, part of this group. They don't even have a name. They don't even want to have a name. They say some people call us the fellowship. And they try to live like Jesus. They live very simply. They've given away their possessions. He came to Funat Bombs. And he just made this kind of sleeveless tunic that he kind of wore over regular clothes. And that had the effect of people, hey, what are you a spiritual person? You know. So there's a lot of room for experimentation. But, yeah, we're getting right into the overtime stuff. I'm happy to go on and on, but I know some people won't. So we'll try to limit it to just one or two more questions. But I'll be available.
Stay a little bit, a couple of days.
Yeah, I'm going to stay a couple of days.
Are you going?
Yeah, yeah. And even right after this, we can have the tea. If anyone wants to come next door, I'd be happy to keep talking.
That's usually the habit for the overtime.
Okay.
Do it.
Okay, so maybe this last question, unless someone else has a burning question, that can be short. You know.
How do you come back to yourself when you notice you're off and you're distracted and you're thinking or doing whatever that's not really helpful for your practice or your life? How do you come back?
Oh, that's the question. That's our practice.
Do you have any fallback practices that you do when you get,
yeah, I mean, our formal practices are kind of a strong... Yeah. Of course, we should just drop it and be present, right? That's what we always try to do.
I'll talk more in daily life.
Yeah, I am too.
Yes.
But sometimes we're really caught, you know?
Yeah.
And it's hard. I have a little obsessive thing. It's just mentioning this because it just happened on this trip. It's often when I'm traveling alone and physically exerting myself and on the bike, you know, I start to pick up a lot of garbage, like way too much. You know, carry it around on the bike. You know, I just see it and I just don't want it there. And I think, but I'm getting late. You know, I'm going to miss my talk and stuff. So that's hard. It kind of grips your mind. And I stop and say, I breathe. You know, breathing is really important. Returning your posture. You know, lifting from here, even when you're standing. You know, lifting from the crown. And if you do physical things like Tai Chi, Qigong, that's really helpful for learning how to relax, settle your weight. All these things really help. But coming to formal practice is really necessary sometimes because we need something stronger. So we sit together with a group, we do our formal Tai Chi, Qigong, and that's teaching us how to do it more immediately in the regular part of the day also. So the more formal practices you can do, even at least for, you know, 10, 20 years to do a lot of formal practices, is going to give you more ability to drop and return to presence in your daily life. But it's always that's our work. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Is that going to do it for now? Okay, so please come afterwards if you'd like to connect more. We have to have at least 30 seconds to forget all these words now. I always consider that really important. These are numbers.